Fianna Fáil are calling for tax breaks for builders and developers to ease the housing crisis. The Health Minister and the anti-vaccine campaign. And sterling falls to an 8-year low against the euro. Just how far can it fall? I'm Ian Guider and you're welcome to The Post Podcast. And you're very welcome to this week's episode of The Post Podcast. The first full week in September. Kids are back in school, roads are busy, and everybody is back behind their desk. And loads of news happening out there. I'm going to be talking about the housing crisis this week and what efforts the government can do to stimulate building activity. We've seen an awful lot of comments over the weekend. We've heard from Fianna Fáil, who want tax breaks for builders and developers. And also we've heard from the government in response to those tragic deaths of several people linked to the fact that they've not been able to find accommodation. And also, what about the other crisis out there, the health crisis? It hasn't gone away, you know. We're going to be finding out why a junior minister and his views on a key anti-cancer drug. But first off this week, I want to talk about something that could have an impact on the Irish economy. Sterling last week hit an 8-year low against the euro. It's come back a little bit in recent days, but how far could it actually fall and what impact could it have on the Irish economy? To discuss this, I'm joined by JJ Walsh from Bank of Ireland Global Markets. JJ, you're very welcome. Thank you very much for coming into Business Post HQ. Just let's go back a bit. The euro last week, it hit about 93 pence. Where was it in the run-up to the Brexit vote?
Hi, Ian. I guess just under 2 years ago, euro sterling was trading below 70p. So it has moved quite a lot since then. It's over 30% higher. Now, a lot of that move happened before the Brexit referendum. It moved by 10% in the run-up to the referendum, so it was at 76p going into the referendum. And after the vote, sterling weakened very sharply, very quickly, and it traded up above 90p against the euro by last October. After that, it recovered a bit, and I guess between November last year and April, May this year, it traded in a range of 83 to 88p. But since April, it's appreciated by another 12%, say from 83p up to current levels. As you said, it hit 93p last week, and it's currently trading around 92p today.
Can we attribute this decline all down to Brexit and the handling of the negotiations since, with a bungled handling, many people would say?
Not quite. I guess all of the weakness last year we can attribute to sterling and to the UK. I think Mark Carney, the head of the Bank of England, recently said that the outcome of the Brexit negotiations is the single biggest factor that will impact on the UK economy in years to come. So last year, I think the fall in sterling was all about the market preparing for that, the slower growth in the UK. This year, since April, I think it's been more about the euro for a couple of reasons. I think there's two things behind it. Number one, politics, and number two, economic factors. In terms of politics, we had important Dutch and French elections early in the year. And following,
got through them okay?
We got through them okay, and there had been heightened concern in the market about elections given some populist results that happened last year. So the market was quite concerned about those. But once it was clear Macron was going to win in France after the Dutch election was already completed, that left European political risk in a good space, and investors moved back into the euro, and the euro started to appreciate strongly. And the second factor then behind that has been the strength of the European economy. It accelerated quite sharply, and growth, the latest figures we have for GDP show it running at 2.2% year on year, which is the best level we've seen since 2011. The unemployment rate has fallen to 9%. It's fallen by 1% in the last 12 months. So the European economy has performed very well also. So it's been a mixture of both. It's not exclusively Europe then as well this year. As you said, the Brexit negotiations, ongoing chatter and leaks haven't been positive for sterling. And again, the Bank of England has had an impact also. In early August, many people had expected the Bank of England, more members might vote for an interest rate hike to counteract above target inflation in the UK. But the vote came in on the dovish side, I guess, and that seemed to give a green light for euro sterling to move back above 90p. So I think maybe since early August, it's been a mixture of both UK and European factors.
If you were an Irish exporter last week, you would have looked at currency markets and probably wrung your hands when you see sterling at 93 and euro dollar at about $1.20. It's come back a little bit. Can we say that perhaps last week and the week before last, perhaps, you know, lack of volume, a lot of noise in the market around the UK economy, around the US economy, have things eased a little bit in the last few days?
They certainly have, and I guess we're coming into an important period now for the currencies. I guess the ongoing negotiations will create headlines which will move markets. We have the party conferences in the UK, the Tory party conference and the Labour party conference, which again will create headlines. It's impossible really to forecast the impact they will have or what those headlines will be. So looking at what we can forecast, looking at what we can analyse, it's the economic performance and it's monetary policy. So there's a few things coming up, I guess. On the UK side, UK growth has fallen off. But it's stabilised at around 1.5%. So it hasn't collapsed completely. Business investment has slowed. Consumer spending growth has slowed also. But on the flip side, exports have done very well, as you'd expect, given the competitive boost it's had. And employment growth has been strong. So the unemployment rate has fallen to the lowest level I think we've seen since the early 1970s. So at the moment, the Bank of England are looking at a trade-off between growth below trend and inflation above target, and it's happy with that at the moment. But if we do see, say, an unemployment rate falling a bit more or inflation picking up a bit more, maybe they might start to prepare the market for an interest rate hike. At the moment, the market doesn't expect that until 2019. If they bring that forward, it could boost sterling. But I think the most important factor in the coming weeks...
European Central Bank.
ECB meeting on Thursday, exactly.
This is key because Mario Draghi, the president, over the summer has made a number of speeches and he's been expected to set out where policy will go, where interest rates will go, and also this massive stimulus, quantitative easing. Will they pull back for it? And he said rather nothing. He's gotten through Jackson Hole and a big speech elsewhere by kind of just, you know, making a pro forma speech about what the ECB have been doing.
Yes, and I guess the dilemma for him is their inflation forecast. The ECB is driven by inflation. The last set of forecasts it produced had inflation running at 1.3% next year and 1.6% in 2019. We'll get their updates on Thursday, and there's two factors, sort of opposite factors, for pushing against that. On the one hand, you have a stronger economic growth, which will bias higher than inflation forecasts, but the strength of the euro counterbalances that. The ECB, traditionally, in their analysis, they have a rule of thumb that suggests for every 5% appreciation in the currency, inflation would fall by 0.2%. The currency is 10% weaker now since they last produced their forecasts, but the latest set of forecasts will only capture 5% of that move. So all else being equal, you'd expect them to reduce their inflation forecasts. Flip side, as I said, growth has been stronger. So whatever they say this week, they have to be mindful of the fact that the euro currency has appreciated by a further 5% since these forecasts were taken.
How do you talk down your own currency?
I guess if he just repeats what he's said all along, at Sintra, the Central Bank ECB symposium, and at the last Central Bank meeting, he referred to a number of factors. Number one, he's confident that monetary policy is working, deflation risk is gone, reflationary forces are at play. But then he went on to say that the inflation dynamic is not yet durable and self-sustaining, so a substantial degree of monetary policy accommodation is still required. So I think he has to reinforce that message. They have said to date they're happy enough with they're comfortable with the level of the euro, but they are concerned that it may overshoot. So I think he will try and whatever he says and whatever they do, it will be guided by preventing the euro overshooting.
Do you think the prospects of an early interest rate increase sometime in the first half of 2018 and the withdrawal of QE are now off the table because of the euro's appreciation?
I think so. I think they've been quite clear about the sequencing. So I think the prospect of an interest rate increase is off the table anyway until after they finish their QE program, their asset purchase program. I think what the market expects now is that we won't get an announcement on the asset purchase program this Thursday. We'll get that at the October meeting, and that they will taper it from January to some extent. I think they will be keen to keep it going. There are technical constraints, which mean they have to reduce the pace of purchases. But given the likely inflation forecast we get this week, given the lack of an inflation dynamic that Mario Draghi has spoken about and the move in the euro we've seen over the last number of months, I think they will be keen to keep the asset purchase programme in place next year, albeit at a reduced level.
I've seen a number of forecasts from the various banks and brokers out there saying that the euro could hit parity with sterling. And as much as I would love it from the point of view of heading over for a few days in London, what do you think the prospects are?
Parity is a funny one.
It's a psychological number really as well, isn't it?
It is. If you you remember at the start of the year, the talk of parity for the euro was parity against the dollar when it was trading around 104, 105. Now we're up near 120. I don't think we get to parity in the coming months. I think we can get a move higher, maybe to 93, 95p. But we've already had a depreciation of over 30% by sterling. As I said, the economy is relatively stable around 1.5% growth. The Bank of England will be watching a trade-off between growth and inflation. The Euro Central Bank doesn't particularly want to see a much stronger currency. Plus, I guess the currency move does provide a significant cushion for the UK economy. So I don't think we see a move to parity. I think we get 93, 95. For about 7 months around the turn of the year, earlier this year, we saw the euro sterling trade in a range of 83 to 88p. I don't think we get back to those levels, but I wouldn't be surprised to see us trading in a range maybe of 90p to 94 or 95p for the next 6 to 7 months.
I was going to say, well, that was my next question. Do you think this is a short-term period where we're going to be trading in this range, or is it a long-term structural thing where we are just going to have to get used to a stronger euro?
I think we need to get used to a stronger euro. I think the average exchange rate for the euro since inception against sterling has been 74p. It was trading there or just below there, I guess, before the Brexit vote became an issue. Whether we get a soft Brexit or a hard Brexit, it does reduce the trend growth rate, I think, in the UK in the coming years. So I think we do have to get used to a weaker sterling than we would have had otherwise. However, the level of that is very hard to forecast. If we get a breakdown in the negotiations, if we get a hard Brexit, it's hard to know how high sterling, euro sterling will go. I think parity certainly comes into the equation in that scenario. However, if we get a softer Brexit or a postponed Brexit, I think, again, you're looking at the 90 to 94 or maybe even slightly lower.
It is incredible that we have the ECB President Mario Draghi, through his career, has not put up interest rates at the European Central Bank, and Mark Carney in the Bank of England has not put interest rates up as well. The two of them could be out of a job before the ECB and the Bank of England put up rates.
Yes, that's very true. It's certainly very surprising given the previous 30, 40 years experience we have had of markets. The market doesn't expect an increase in the UK until 2019, whereas the first increase from the ECB is probably further out again. It's hard to work out the levels, but it looks like it's 2020 sometime. So yes, I don't think there's any prospect of an interest rate increase in either economy in the near term. The UK is more likely, as I said, given the trade-off it's currently making between growth and inflation. But yeah, it is strange, and it's something that's going to continue, I think, for the coming months.
Yeah, an interesting time out there for central bank watchers. JJ Walsh from Bank of Ireland Global Markets, thank you very much for joining us on the Post podcast. We'll be back in just a moment.
In today's busy world, the Business Post prides itself in quality independent journalism. We provide trusted comment and analysis on the stories that matter. Our award-winning journalists provide in-depth insights on our 7-day digital offering across a mobile responsive website, apps and e-paper. Subscribe today and gain immediate access to a trusted news source.
Now, the junior health minister, Finian McGrath, has found himself at the centre of attention over an anti-vaccine campaign. Let's find out about the science and medics behind the HPV jab, and also the politics about it as well, and if he can stay in his job credibly. Our health editor, Susan Mitchell, is with us, as is our political correspondent, Hugh O'Connell. Susan, we've heard a lot of PR in the last number of weeks of people who are anti the HPV jab. Maybe just tell us the medical stats behind it. What type of take-up of the jab have we seen since it came into effect in Ireland, and where is it now?
Okay, so when the vaccine was first introduced, there was a high take-up, actually. About 87% of girls who were eligible to get the vaccine, which is administered through schools, took the vaccine. But since then, there's been a very coordinated attempt to undermine the safety profile of the vaccine, and uptake has dropped to 50%. So this is why we've seen the likes of the HSE and indeed the HPV Alliance, which includes a whole host of different charities and women's representative groups, trying to promote the vaccine and reassure parents that this is a safe vaccine, in that all of the available medical and scientific evidence shows its safety profile to be excellent, and also that it is a very effective vaccine.
Yeah, what are the campaigners against it? What is their claim, and has it stacked up anywhere else?
No, it hasn't. So look, I think we should distinguish between people who, parents who have very legitimate concerns about their daughters and those who are actively campaigning to stop the use of the vaccine based on complete pseudoscience and because they are anti-vaxxers at heart or conspiracy theorists. So parents have... Initially, the initial group that came out against this vaccine is called Regret. And I've done a good bit of work on Regret and tried to get answers repeatedly from them around some of their claims. They refused to answer basic answers such as, you know, one of the claims they put out was there are 200 girls on suicide watch 24/7. Now, very many doctors I've spoken to who work in mental health have said if there were 200 girls on suicide watch 24/7, we would be aware of it. Regret has failed to answer any questions around things like that. But in a nutshell, what they say is that their daughters have suffered adverse events or effects from this vaccine, that many of them are laid up in bed, that they suffer symptoms such as chronic fatigue syndrome, etc., and other types of conditions. The reality is that the medicine, the science, study after study, and millions of girls have been studied all across the globe, does not support a causal link between what they're experiencing and the vaccine. And many of these illnesses and conditions are just as prevalent in the unvaccinated population as they are in the vaccinated population. So they, in other words, these symptoms, these conditions manifest very often at this age.
Hugh O'Connell, how has Finian McGrath been dragged into this controversy? And somebody like Finian McGrath, who has over the many years campaigned for quite a lot in the medical area around disability, around other treatments, how has he found himself? Controversy is one thing, but this is an absolute own goal.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's very simple. I mean, Finian McGrath is the self-styled maverick who says what he thinks, has strong views, has strong views on the disability sector. He's the junior minister for disabilities. He has a daughter with Down syndrome. He's campaigned in the area of disabilities for years, and he's now working as the minister in that sector to try and get some stuff done there. And he's had a reasonable amount of success so far, I should say. But he does have a habit of putting his foot in it, and that comes from essentially being ill-informed. So, for example, last year, in the first few weeks of his time in office, he said that the government should row back on the smoking ban. And one of the reasons he did this is because he's a smoker and he thinks smokers should be given a break, and he thinks they're being penalised, that cigarettes are too expensive and that people should stop having a go at smokers, and that, you know, he wanted designated smoking areas in bars and restaurants, something we got rid of 14 years ago.
I can get over silly comments like that, but this is interfering in medicine.
Yeah, so this stems from a PQ that he put in 2015. Last year, 2016, just before he came to office as a government minister, where he basically called for Leo Varadkar to stop the administration of the HPV vaccine, people getting the jab. He called for that to stop. And the Sunday Times contacted him about this, and he said he stood by his views. And we're talking about people's lives here. This vaccine saves people's lives. And I think the fact that the vaccination rate has dropped so dramatically over the last couple of years, I think from 90% down to just under 50%, means that people's lives are being put at risk here. Women's lives are being put at risk here by not getting the vaccine. And that's extraordinarily dangerous, and it's extraordinarily irresponsible of a government minister to do that.
Now, he wrote back fairly quickly, but Susan, the reaction from the medical community, what are you hearing?
People are pretty outraged. We had doctors coming out all last week trying to reassure concerned parents, many of whom are sitting on the fence and are genuinely concerned because they're seeing various different reports and heart-rending stories on social media, etc. And then you have the junior minister for health come out and express concern and allude to some study that he thinks he may have read in some office about, you know, adverse effects in the UK. The study doesn't actually exist. It's nonsense. It's rubbish. But to come out and undermine a public health campaign and not even do your research, not even try and get a briefing as a minister to actually educate yourself on the facts before you do this is just a disgrace.
Yeah, and I mean, like, he has form with this. Like, so when he spoke to us last year about his his view that there should be designated smoking sections in bars and pubs. He talked about how he was in Germany a couple of years ago, and I think it was in Frankfurt, and they had a similar position, and I saw that it was working there, that, at these designated smoking areas. So this is a guy who you know, tends to have you know, his say on matters of public health without being particularly well informed about it.
Why hasn't he been sacked?
Well, I don't know. Should he be sacked?
Well, personally, I think he should, based on both his irresponsible comments about smoking and questioning the underlying link, etc., between smoking and lung cancer, which he effectively did in a previous interview with you, and also on his comments about the cervical cancer vaccine. I mean, the reality is some parents will sadly listen or will have read what he said, and it'll be the nail in the coffin in that
it's
they will
no
decide
smoke
not
without fire
to proceed.
Thing.
Exactly, that they will decide, but quite possibly not to proceed with vaccinating their daughters. And that could actually lead to some of those girls dying down the line. So it's incredibly irresponsible. And as for his so-called U-turn, it was a pretty soft U-turn. I didn't think it was a very hard-hitting statement endorsing the vaccination campaign at all. He said he still effectively stood over concerns and his right to raise concerns for parents and so-called support groups. So it wasn't much of a U-turn. And sadly, the political repercussions don't seem to exist.
TDs have a right to raise concerns, but they also have a responsibility to inform themselves. And that is not the case in this instance. Here's the reason why he won't be sacked. There's a political reality that dictates that he needs to remain in government, because if he was to be sacked, the Independent Alliance would effectively pull out of government. I mean, I can't see Shane Ross sticking around if his cabinet colleague, or his colleague who sits at the cabinet table with him was kicked out of government. So the government would fall if Finney McGrath was booted out of office over this. And, you know, ultimately the calculation is made that do we want the government to fall over remarks about a vaccine.
So is the Independent Alliance actually supporting his position then, or has anyone asked
them? Well, no, I actually don't think anyone's asked them, Susan, so that, you know, that might be something worth asking this week. But I think that it's unlikely that the Independent Alliance would have supported. I would have thought. Now, I don't know for sure, but I would have a reasonable idea that they would not support a position whereby Finney McGrath would be sacked and they would still stay in government. He's come under pressure to resign. I don't think he will. There's no push from within Fine Gael to get rid of him. So there seems to have been a political calculation here that it's not worth the hassle of sacking him, threatening the stability of government, threatening the existence of government. Over what are really stupid and dangerous remarks.
Yeah, and speaking of danger, this is not the first story we've seen in the last number of months about various medicines and various treatments. Am I missing something here, Susan, which there seems to be an awful lot of pseudoscience going on about people raising concerns about various treatments?
Well, there's been issues around other vaccines. For example, there's been a reduction in the uptake of vaccines that are given to kids, such as measles, in various countries around Europe and indeed in the States. We've seen that, I don't want to libel the individual, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, so-called Dr. Andrew Wakefield, have a, you know, return with a vengeance. And he's in cahoots with a crowd called Vaxxed, which is a staunch anti-vaccine organisation that has released a film that has been shown all over the world. So there does seem to be an anti-vaccine movement that appears to be growing. But I mean, concerns around vaccines have existed for centuries. And, you know, I've been reading some reports around, you know, the psychology behind the whole issue. And certainly when it comes to childhood vaccines such as measles, polio, etc., one of the theories is that, you know, we in the Western world or the developed world no longer actually see these illnesses. So we have no idea, or parents have no idea, just how devastating they can be. But instead, when they go onto social media like Facebook or Twitter or wherever else they're spending their time, they see individual stories and scaremongering, etc. And that is unfortunately taking hold.
And Susan, just finally, as you said, the HSE and Simon Harris, the health minister, have a campaign to get the take up back up there again. I mean, we've seen Simon Harris take to Twitter quite a lot over the last few days. Do the HSE have a new target they want to get to, having been down now as low as 50%?
Actually, I'm not aware of the specific target that they have. have in mind. They certainly want to increase the uptake because, you know, HPV is something that also affects males. It's not just something that leads to cervical cancer. It leads to various other types of cancers, including anal cancer, penile cancer, throat and neck cancers, etc. So they're by women not get or girls not getting vaccinated, this has an impact on the wider population, not just themselves. So they need to get the rates back up.
Okay, Susan Mitchell, health editor, thank you very much for joining us. Now, Hugh O'Connell is still with us because we're going to talk politics and we're going to talk the biggest story facing the country right now, which is the housing crisis. We have seen tragic deaths in the last number of days linked to people who have been unable to find accommodation. But what are the solutions to the crisis? Well, Fianna Fáil are looking for tax breaks to be given to builders and developers in Budget 2018. So let's find out whether the government are open to them and what Fine Gael are looking for. Hugh O'Connell, you spoke to Fianna Fáil's housing spokesman Barry Cowan last week. What does he want the government to do?
Well, he's been quite clear, as he was on the front page of our newspaper at the weekend, that there should be incentives for developers. Specifically, he wants the VAT rate for the residential construction industry to be cut from 13.5% to 9%, and various incentives and tax release for developers to get them out there to start building. Now, most estimates put the cost of building a house right now, particularly in Dublin, in and around €330,000. The Construction Industry Federation has said that this is a barrier to development, and they have long argued, for the VAT rate to be cut in the same way in which the VAT rate in the tourism and hospitality sector was cut in 2011 or 12, I think, from 13.5% to 9%, and was a huge boon to that industry, created tens of thousands of jobs and increased tourism and increased revenue for the state. Very important. Here we have a national crisis. We're not building enough houses in this country. And Fianna Fáil are proposing ways in which to get developers and builders constructing houses as soon as possible, and particularly affordable houses. So they fleshed out the detail of that policy in the last 24 hours in and around providing these reliefs for builders who are going to build homes that cost €400,000 or less for those who are trying to purchase them. So it's a good idea. It's led to the inevitable, or some people would say it's a good idea. Fianna Fáil certainly think that. But as the objective journalist, I would say that, you know, there is merit perhaps in that argument, but there's equally merit to the idea that we perhaps shouldn't be incentivizing developers in the way in which we used to in this country, because it could have all sorts of unintended consequences. And of course, the political charge is that Fianna Fáil are jumping
looking after their old builder and developer
and the Galway tent and all of that kind of stuff again.
You know, I would have been one of those people who would say, look, there are certain developers out there who are sitting on sites, hoarding them, not to build, but so that they can flip them and clear their debts with their various banks. I'm still partially of the view that there are some people like that, but we're now at the stage where housing is becoming, if we look at the health system, we've always thought that's a crisis. This is something that's even more when you see the tragic deaths we've had in the last couple of days.
Yeah, and look, that's in August and September, and we're coming into the winter now. The weather's going to get a lot colder. And like, if we're having people dying in the summer months and the early autumn months, what's it going to be like when we get into the depths of winter? Like, it doesn't bear thinking about. And the homeless figures are not good. They're going up. And I think that, like, it's quite clear now at this point, and I think everyone's kind of moving in this direction politically, at least, that we need to build more social housing in this country. We haven't done enough over the last 10 to 15 years, even longer, 20, 25 years. Not since the 1980s have we had major social housing programs in this country. Now, Leo Varadkar and the Housing Minister Owen Murphy have indicated there's a move towards that. We had an interview with Owen Murphy in the paper a few weeks ago in which he indicated the state would be ramping up the construction and supply of social and affordable housing. But until we actually get that moving, there isn't going to be any change here in the current situation where the homeless crisis is leading to people dying.
I listened to Pascal Donoghue, the finance minister, on Sean O'Rourke on Friday. I heard Simon Coveney, the former housing minister, now foreign minister, on News Talk with Chris Donoghue on Sunday. Mm. And Owen Murphy in a very robust interview with Áine Lawler on the News at One.
That's right, yeah.
On Monday. Is there a sense that the government actually now understand how serious this crisis is?
Yeah, I mean, they do. I don't think they have been completely unaware of how much of a crisis
it is. But
that
needs them to come up with a response. That's something that they would have felt palatable see, there's before that they have to do now.
Yeah, there's almost a fatigue, though, now at this stage, because we're going to have another housing strategy later this month, which is the review of the Rebuilding Ireland strategy, which was launched last year. And there's going to be some tweaks and changes and new priorities and all this sort of stuff. And I'm sure there'll be a press conference and a fancy document. And, like, we need to start building houses, like, supply. That's not happened in the last 2 to 3 years, even though we have thrown literally billions at this problem. The state has fronted up billions. Owen Murphy has said it repeatedly. The money is not an issue here. It's just getting the money into the right places, and it's getting people, getting developers, getting builders, building houses. And that's not happened. So I think there is, there is an awareness in government that this is a major issue, but I think they also have to be aware that it's becoming increasingly intractable. And I think you sensed in that interview, particularly with Owen Murphy on the News at One yesterday, was a frustration at this stage that the government is getting hammered over this when it's throwing all the money and all the strategies in the world at it, and there's no benefit. So, look, the only way that we solve this problem is if we start building houses. We haven't built enough over the last 5 years anyway, and probably going back beyond that, pre the Celtic Tiger. So until that starts happening, there will be no change to this crisis. And politically, there will be no... Like, the politics of the housing crisis are interesting because no party will come in and overnight solve the housing crisis. And no party is going to win votes off solving the housing crisis, because it's a human right for many people and many voters that they should just have a roof over their head.
Do you think we're at that stage now where, as unpalatable as it is, that perhaps Fine Gael are willing to concede the Fianna Fáil point of cutting VAT, that perhaps they are willing to do something such as give local authorities money to build houses again?
I think they haven't explicitly ruled out what Fianna Fáil are proposing, but I think they'd be pretty lukewarm on it at the moment. The focus from the government seems to be more social housing and finding ways in which to get local authorities building houses, because they're not doing it at the moment. That's why we've seen floated in the last week or so this idea of a semi-state to take powers from local authorities to build houses. Many people are asking, well, why can't NAMA do that?
Yeah, NAMA, I think, were given a job several years ago to build houses. They'll say, we are doing it. Of course, they're selling off the land on which to build some of the houses as well. Hugh O'Connell, our political correspondent, thank you very much for joining us. That's it for the Post podcast this week. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, more business news and analysis on our website, businesspost.ie. Back next week.